From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, should Michigan let 85% of a road's drivers set the speed limit with their speed?
The question is really, you know, is this the proper use of the tool to kind of pluck it out of other ways of determining our speed limits?
We look at the latest deficit district report from the state school superintendent.
Currently, there are 46 districts operating in a deficit. That number dropped by 4, but it's not necessarily good news.
We find out why, and it's tough for our vets.
It's difficult to serve, and people are coming back with significant problems.
So why is Michigan last in the nation when it comes to per capita spending on our military veterans? Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us on this very, very cold Monday. Military veterans don't have it easy, and we often say we want to help them. But Michigan ranks last in the nation when it comes to per capita spending on our veterans. On today's show, why the disconnect between what we say about veterans and what we actually do. And then it's not just us, you know, humans that are dealing with this crazy winter weather. The season has been especially bad for an already fragile population in our state, honeybees.
Certainly we're concerned in Michigan because we're a very big fruit and vegetable state. And we have to have healthy bees in May when the apples and blueberries and cherries are going to bloom in order to get an abundant. It's not just the amount of crop, it's also the quality of the crop. If you don't get good pollination, you don't get a well-shaped apple, for example.
We'll check in on our honeybees and what their livelihood means for Michigan crops this spring and summer. But first, there are fewer Michigan school districts running into the red this year, and even more are projected to work their way out of budget deficits by the end of the school year. State Senator Howard Walker chairs the Senate K-12 Budget Subcommittee.
I'm encouraged that we're trending in the right direction as far as number of schools moving into deficit and the number of schools moving out of deficit.
But peel away the top layer, and it's not all good news. Joining us to explain why is MLive Capital reporter Jonathan Osting. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, how are you, Cindy?
Good. So Michigan State Superintendent Mike Flanagan essentially delivered a deficit district report card to a joint session of the House and Senate Appropriations Committee late last week. So at the end of last school year, there were 50 districts operating at a deficit. What do we see this year?
Currently there are 46 districts operating in a deficit. That number dropped by 4, but it's not necessarily good news. Two districts were dissolved after the school year ended in response to financial emergencies. One Detroit charter school was closed by its operator in the midst of financial struggles as well. And then Ypsilanti ended up merging with Willow Run. So there's fewer districts in deficit, but that's, as I mentioned, not necessarily a great thing. The good news is that a larger number are projected to come out of deficit this year than go in. So that number could potentially shrink again next year.
Okay. So of the 46 now in deficit, can we get a sense what they have in common?
Well, that was a question that lawmakers had for Superintendent Flanagan, and you know he didn't really provide one succinct answer, but pointed to some larger trends, larger problems. He did, as he often does, reiterate calls for more financial support for at-risk districts, saying they simply need more money. But he also pointed to huge drops in student enrollment over the last few years that have really impacted districts across this state. Enrollment numbers are projected to drop by more than 12,000 students this year, another 9,000 next year. And because districts rely on per-pupil funding, the loss of students essentially means less money to them each year and puts them in the awkward position perhaps of having to then lay off teachers, close buildings, consider consolidation, et cetera.
And that's what I was wondering, Jonathan. Are we hearing the drumbeats of a call for consolidation?
Yeah, I mean, Mike Flanagan has often talked about consolidation, but he sort of stepped up that call last week, saying that, you know, perhaps the state needs to stop using a carrot and perhaps take a more aggressive approach. I don't think he'd call it a stick, but his basic argument is that, you know, districts are really not all that interested in consolidating themselves. They're not taking the reins in these situations like they should. And he and lawmakers debated various ways that they might encourage more consolidation moving forward. He pointed to Ypsilanti and Willow Run as a model that other districts across the state could consider.
What is it that he thinks is working well with that consolidation?
Well, simply that they didn't have the student population anymore to support two separate districts. So instead of just sharing services, which is one other form of consolidation, they literally just merged the schools together. As more and more schools face population declines, you know, the potential for dissolution is there, which happened to Buena Vista and Saginaw and Inkster mm-hmm. last year. And instead of simply dissolving and then forcing or leading the state to sort of pawn off parts individually to other districts, Ypsilanti and Willow Run took a proactive approach to it and decided to join forces before it got to that point.
Jonathan, what did the superintendent warn about other districts? Did I hear something about he fears some other districts may go off the cliff?
Yeah. He used that cliff reference several times. And again, for Flanagan, it comes down to the idea that districts aren't necessarily in a position to take the steps they need to. Part of that is that their local school boards are elected. Closing buildings, for instance, is never going to be a popular decision in a local community,
no.
Which makes it a tough call for school board members. So Flanagan, in what seemed to be initially sort of off the cuff, but then this idea that he really developed was that the state legislature could give local superintendents more authority to take actions on their own in the face of financial crises. So he talked about perhaps allowing those superintendents to close buildings on their own. Superintendents, of course, don't have to answer to voting the voting population. However, the school board could then, you know, the school board makes the call on whether superintendents keep their jobs. So
there
if
you
the
go.
School board disagreed with a building closure, they could then fire the superintendent. But Flanagan said that perhaps giving that super more authority, as he has at the state level, might take some of the politics out of the equation.
He also used an interesting term that harkens back to immediately after World War II when Superintendent Flanagan called for what he called a Marshall Plan to boost the funding. This is, of course, the U.S. airdropping in supplies into mm-hmm. Germany after World War II when it was surrounded by the Soviets. So what does he mean by the Marshall Plan?
He simply means more resources. There currently is a formula by which the state provides some additional resources to at-risk districts, but he thinks that number should be a lot larger. You know, regardless of all the other issues facing school districts, you know, he argued that it's simply tough for them to resolve all of their problems without more money. Now, as he pointed to closures, et cetera, he said, you know, money isn't the only issue, but there needs to be more of it for these, specifically for these struggling districts.
Well, here's a question then. Is there an appetite in the state legislature to listen to what Superintendent Flanagan's calling for, whether it's more funding or whether it's the idea of more consolidation? Is the legislature listening?
They're listening, yeah. There's going to be, you know, some modest increases in education funding this year. It remains to be seen whether they will revisit the formula for targeting at-risk districts. There certainly seems to be a healthy discussion about consolidation, but there's a lot of people on a lot of different sides of the issue. Senator Papa George, who has long pushed for consolidation, said, you know, districts aren't going to do it on their own. He said, just talk to the local high school football coach. You know, nobody's going to want, you know, these sort of community leaders aren't going to advocate for closing schools or merging with other districts. He suggested the state needs to perhaps just tell districts to do it rather than trying to incentivize them to consolidate as they are now. Of course, that sort of top-heavy, top-down approach probably won't play well in local communities either.
So what should we be watching for now?
This was a quarterly report from the superintendent, and these ideas he floats were really in their early stages. So this idea of, giving more power to superintendents, I think it's the first time Flanagan has publicly made that pitch. So I wouldn't expect any action on that in the immediate future. But what will be interesting to see is whether these projections actually come to fruition, whether more districts are able to claw their way out of deficit this year, or whether the problem continues to be exacerbated.
MLive Capital correspondent Jonathan Osting. Thanks so much, Jonathan. Always good to talk with you.
Hey, thank you, Cindy. Appreciate it.
And as we mentioned, State Superintendent Mike Flanagan says too many districts are not making tough choices like closing buildings or consolidating with their neighbors when financial troubles loom.
Boards need to make some of these decisions earlier. If, for example, you've lost 50% of your enrollment, you can't go 5 years without cutting the number of schools you have.
Flanagan says no school district has accepted the state's offer of money to help them make plans to consolidate. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. There's no shortage of attention that is showered upon our veterans. A true bipartisan show of support happened recently during the State of the Union speech when President Obama singled out wounded Army Ranger Corey Remsburg for a standing ovation. We stand up to offer ovations. We wave flags. We cheer our vets. But what are we really offering them in terms of support? Well, check this out. When it comes to per capita spending on veterans, Michigan is last in the nation, 50th out of the 50 states. What should we be doing for the 700,000 military veterans who call Michigan home? Joining me now is Kristen Haas. She's American Culture Director of Graduate Studies at the University of Michigan, and she's author of Sacrificing Soldiers, New War Memorials on the National Mall. Very good to have you with us, Kristen.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, so much talk and attention paid to our veterans, especially our wounded vets from Iraq and Afghanistan. So why do you think that has not translated into tangible help and support, into resources for our vets?
The gap, as you're pointing out, between the rhetoric and what we're actually providing our soldiers is terrible. And most people are unaware of that gap.
There you go.
So the gap actually has a long history because it didn't used to be the case. It used to be, after World War II, for instance, the case that the veterans got the greatest public works program, the greatest welfare program in the history of the planet, the GI Bill.
Sure.
So they got free money to buy a house and they got a free education, and institutions like the University of Michigan were transformed by the students who were coming in.
Yeah.
And the moment when it changed was at the end of the Vietnam War, really, because the kind of war we were fighting changed and the soldiers we were asking to fight in our wars changed.
How so?
The draft started for the first time in the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And during the Civil War, you could either respond to your draft call or pay $300 to get out of the draft. Which was profoundly unfair and really punished the poor.
Certainly.
World War I and World War II, that wasn't the case. Those were our most egalitarian moments for military service.
Everybody jumped on board.
Everybody. There weren't as many exemptions.
Right.
And there were wars that people, particularly World War II, obviously, that the country was united in supporting and people really wanted to serve. And even the people who didn't want to serve knew that they were going to be called, and they were going to be called no matter where they stood in the social spectrum in the United States. So, but by the time we got to Vietnam, we were still in a draft, but it was a draft that was really defined by the exemptions. Like the Civil War again. So it meant that if you were going to college or if you could go to college, you didn't have to serve necessarily. And so working class, Irish, Italian, Catholics, working class Mexican Americans, working class African Americans, Native people, and Puerto Ricans. These are the people who served, the working class from these backgrounds. But they were also the possibility existed that these guys in college could get called up, so they were more invested. So everybody was more – there was a possibility that you would know someone even if you weren't working class. Or there was a possibility if you weren't working class that your son could go or your husband. So people were more aware. They were more invested. And the issue of the draft and who served actually became really important at the end of the war. And Nixon ran on the promise that he would end the draft.
Yes.
And he did.
I'm speaking with Kristen Haas, who is American Culture Director of Graduate Studies at the University of Michigan, and she's the author of Sacrificing Soldiers, New War Memorials on the National Mall. And Kristen, when I see the VA figures from 2010 that Michigan got $2.2 billion in veterans funding, that's an average of just over $3,400 per capita, where the national average is just under $5,000 per capita, what is it, do you think, that has Michigan with such a rotten track record of getting assistance and support into the hands of veterans?
Well, I mean, that's an enormous question that's really outside of my specialty. But I think Michigan, we are like so many other states in that we are invested in the rhetoric, but not actually. There isn't political pressure to actually invest in the soldiers themselves. So even though there are great people who are working at the VA.
Sure. And
all of that, that there is this...
There's a disconnect somewhere, isn't
profound
there?
Profound disconnect.
And is that on both parts? Number one, in getting the word out to veterans, but is there also a disconnect with the veterans perhaps just not wanting to get back into the arms of the government?
I think so. I think so. And I think there's a profound, for some, a distrust. Like, what's the VA going to do for me? Am I going to have to deal with all this paperwork? And you know, we have – the federal government has improved the resources that it has made available to veterans. The GI Bill in 2010 was improved fairly dramatically. But there is still a sense among many veterans that they remember, you know, not having some of the right equipment when they were, in active duty. They have a sense that, you know, they're not really going to get what they – what they're being told they're going to get. So there are multiple gaps that need to be filled. And, you know, there should be political pressure to figure out, why are we 50?
Yeah.
50? We don't want to be 50.
We don't want to be 50. With the people who are fighting our wars today, Kristen, and then coming home as veterans, explain and compare for us who those folks are compared to perhaps after World War II.
So after World War II, everybody came home together, and they came home sons of lawyers and sons of doctors and sons of mail carriers and sons of factory workers and sons of farmers. They were from all walks of life, but how they received their benefits was very straightforward, and they came home – they had a community. They had a very deep community to return to that appreciated what they were doing, and they had – resources to figure out how to get the benefits that were available to them. Many of the people who are serving now, you know, many of the people who are serving are from military families and are not people who didn't have other options. Mm-hmm. But many of the people who are serving now are people without significant resources, without a lot of education, without families with a lot of education. And it can be very overwhelming to come back and try and negotiate the system, particularly because people are coming back, you know, it's difficult to serve, and people are coming back with significant emotional,
damage, physical
problems.
Yeah.
And so these people who might have found it difficult to navigate the system anyway because of their educational background, because of the kind of world that they grew up in, have that problem to face, and it's compounded by the difficulties that they faced in the war and the problems that they bring home. So a lot of these people have to have a hard time accessing the resources. And then the resources aren't necessarily – I mean, I know that the VA in many ways is trying, you know, around the issue of veteran suicide.
Sure.
But, you know, frankly, sort of reading the documents that I've read and listening to the reports, they're a little baffled about how to address the problem of getting women into the VA, women who have experienced a lot of harassment from men while they were serving. Mm-hmm. They don't even want to walk into the hospitals, right? So they have doors, you know, separate entrances is an idea to kind of give them access. So there are all kinds of problems of access. And the Department of Defense wants to claim some problems as pre-existing, you know, so we don't want to – you're homeless because you're alcoholic and that was a pre-existing problem. You know, I mean, there's sort of – none of it is really simple. And for this population, it's very difficult.
And this population, dare I say, is perhaps easier to overlook for the rest of the public.
They're not senators' sons and daughters, right?
Kristen Haas, American Culture Director of Graduate Studies at the University of Michigan, and her book is Sacrificing Soldiers, New War Memorials on the National Mall. Pleasure to talk with you, Kristen. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this winter has been especially hard on an already fragile population in Michigan, our honeybees. Beekeepers are already coping with a nearly decade-long decline in commercial honeybees and their wild cousins. It's called colony collapse disorder. And now comes the unrelenting cold of this record-setting winter, and beekeepers in Michigan and other states are reporting staggering losses that could endanger crop production all over the nation. So the U.S. Department of Agriculture has announced it's spending $3 million in a program to help honeybees. Let's find out why this is so crucial and what it means for Michigan's farmers and beekeepers. Mike Hansen is the state apiarist with Michigan Department of Agriculture and Rural Development. Welcome, Mike.
Hey, how are you today?
Good to have you with us. And Brian Thomas is with the USDA, and he is based here in Michigan in East Lansing. Good to have you with us, Brian.
And it's good to be here.
So give us a sense of this, Mike. What is the colony collapse disorder, and how badly have Michigan hives been affected?
The actual colony collapse disorder is typified by a sudden loss of adult bees. They just disappear. We're not sure what's happening. And then you end up with a queen with a small number of bees and a lot of brood in the colony, a lot of young bees being raised. There's no reason for the bees to have left, but they seem to have come up missing. And when we do a real good kind of an autopsy, or you can do a real good crime scene investigation, so to speak, maybe 8 or 10% of our losses can really be claimed to be colony collapse disease or disorder. But the when you really look at it close, parasitic mites, pesticides cause some of the problems, long overwintering of bees that aren't as healthy as they need to be to overwinter. All of these are major things that cause bee losses.
Mike, can you help us understand why losing honeybees is so troubling in terms of our fruit and vegetable crops?
We know that honeybee pollination, just honeybee pollination alone, is worth about $18 billion a year to U.S. crops. That's the amount of crops that are produced due to honeybee pollination.
Hmm.
In Michigan, we're proud that we raise some 300 different crops. Now, not all those crops are fruits and vegetables, but of maybe 200 different fruits, vegetables, and other products like that, honeybee pollination is almost essential in 60 of those crops and very beneficial in a whole lot of others. We see a lot of soybeans in Michigan. We don't think of honeybee pollination in soybeans, but when honeybees do pollinate soybeans, you get a larger crop.
Hmm.
And some soybean growers have been very fortunate to have bees in their areas. But certainly we're concerned in Michigan because we're a very big fruit and vegetable state, and we have to have healthy bees in May when the apples and blueberries and cherries are going to bloom in order to get an abundant. It's not just the amount of crop, it's also the quality of the crop. If you don't get good pollination, you don't get a well-shaped apple, for example. So it's not just quality, but quantity, but it's also the quality of the crop absolutely relies on pollinators. And we have a lot of native pollinators in Michigan, different type of solitary bees, alkali bees, leafcutter bees, bumblebees, wood-boring bees. All of those play an important role, but the honeybees are the insect that can be put into a crop in large numbers and to assure that you have good pollination.
So here we have the U.S. Department of Agriculture saying, all right, it's important. We need to boost the honeybees, and it's worth $3 million. Tell us about this program, Brian.
Basically, we're targeting money from our existing authorities through the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, and we identified practices that we have available already in EQIP, and we've targeted them to this effort to help provide forage during the summer months for honeybees. So it isn't, you know, you heard a whole host of things that are threats to the honeybees. Mm-hmm. We're only providing one small part, and we're using our existing program to do that. So we're using things like we call conservation cover, which is basically grass plantings, or cover crop, which we put into a, will entice the landowner through the cost share program to put a portion of a field into a cover crop that provides bee forage during the summer months. And that's only one part of the issue with bees. You heard all about insecticides and pesticides and the mites. We're not, we don't have a program to treat all that, but we can provide some bee forage opportunities for the bees as they're going through the summer months in Michigan, and so that they're in good shape when they are translocated back down to Florida or California for pollinator services.
So basically make it a welcoming terrain for the honeybees.
Yes. My understanding is that there's been, in more recent years, there's been a decrease in the amount, for various reasons, decrease in the amount of available bee forage, and there's been a reduction in the health of the hives through the summer months. And so this is one little piece of trying to make them improve their health so that they can survive all these other things that are coming at them better.
So there's some federal funding available if you apply. Who should apply, and by when should they apply?
March 21st is our cutoff date, but landowners can apply. This is targeted to the ag producers that may or may not have bees. You don't have to own bees to apply, but one of the things we recognize is that bees don't forage very far. My understanding is they forage about a mile radius, so we're trying to limit the applications to land that's within a mile of a known apiary, and we've defined an apiary for the purpose of this to be five or more hives that are located throughout the summer, and we're talking July, August, and September is being the most critical time. And then we use, if they're eligible, then we'll apply our conservation practices to provide bee forage areas.
And Mike Hansen, what are your hopes for what could come from this federal grant program?
Well, I think it's important to say that it's not just Michigan, but there are five states that are benefiting for a total of $15 million. And in some of our neighboring states, well, actually, and it's the five states that receive about 65% of the honeybee colonies during the summer. So our commercial beekeepers come to the Midwest to put on honey, to raise a honey crop. Once pollination is done, the Midwest is where you get honey. And in some of those states, the crops are almost monoculture. You'll have sunflowers for miles and miles and canola for miles and miles. And bees need a mixture of pollen in order to be healthy. They use pollen for food. It's very important to have a mixture so you get a good assortment of vitamins. So having forage of this nature in an area that can produce a very strong assortment of bloom, nectar and pollen throughout the summer, where otherwise we would have a dearth and our bees would actually go backwards if they don't have enough nectar and pollen, this just creates a lot better opportunity through better nutrition for bees to have strong bee health, and it's going to be very important throughout the Midwest.
That was Mike Hansen. He's the state apiarist with the Michigan Department of Agriculture and Rural Development, and he was joined by Brian Thomas, who's with the USDA. And once again, as Brian said, the deadline for applying for the federal dollars is March the 21st, and you can do it through any USDA local office here in Michigan. Guys, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio, and I am Cynthia Canty. We are now into week two of the trial in federal court in Detroit, centering on the challenge to Michigan's constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. Two Hazel Park nurses are challenging the ban, which was passed by Michigan voters in 2004. The women want to get married so they can adopt each other's children. As picketers on both sides of the issue march outside the federal court building in downtown Detroit, we get word of a new state of the state survey conducted by Michigan State University. It finds a majority of Michigan residents support gay marriage. Joining us now is MSU economics professor Charles Ballard. He directs this survey. Charlie, what does the data tell us? What kind of support for gay marriage did you find?
Well, in our latest survey, which just finished quite recently in February, we found 54.3% favor gay marriage, 35.5% opposed. So that's a pretty substantial gap in favor, and then the other 10% said that they were neutral on the issue. This is similar to what we found 2 years ago, but it's quite different from what we found 4 years ago when a majority were opposed to gay marriage. And what it looks like is nationally, many public opinion surveys have indicated that there's been a change in attitude over a long period going back to the 1990s. But it looks like in Michigan, the most dramatic moment was a few years ago, and there was a sort of a flip on the issue. And we've now had two consecutive surveys giving very similar results. And what that suggests is that this is not a blip. This is a trend. This is a long-term change in public attitudes toward gay marriage.
So do we have any idea what can you put a finger on what might have happened between 2010 and 2012 to start causing this shift?
Well, I think that a big part of it was just more and more gays and lesbians were coming out to their friends. And so it became less foreign to many straight residents in Michigan and around the country. And I will tell you that I think that programs like Will and Grace and Modern Family had a tremendous influence in sort of changing the views that people have of gays and lesbians.
Well, now, based on what you found then, Charlie, in this latest state of the state survey, if that vote on same-sex constitutional amendment were to happen today, now we know in 2004 we had more than 58% of voters approving that constitutional amendment, saying marriage is between a man and a woman. So that was 2004. If it happened today, would that amendment fail, do you think?
I think if it were to be voted upon today, the result would be the opposite of what we had in 2004. I hasten to add that I believe that the vote in 2004 was probably a fairly accurate reflection of public attitudes then. But as you mentioned, there's a recent national survey that says from 2003 till now, a change of more than 20 percentage points.
Yeah.
And we did not ask the gay marriage question back in 2004. We only started asking it in 2010. But we've seen a very substantial change even in the last 4 years. And if you put that together with other surveys, the Gallup organization, the Pew Trust, that have been tracking these since the 90s, it certainly looks like the vote in 2004 was probably pretty representative of Michigan's views then. Now those views appear to have changed a great deal. So I think that if the vote were to happen now in 2014 or 2016, probably you'd get the opposite result.
Now, politically speaking, your survey does kind of break it down. Can you compare Republican versus Democratic support for same-sex marriage in Michigan?
Well, perhaps not surprisingly, Republicans are much less likely to support gay marriage, with about 30% versus the statewide average of 54%. And then Democrats more likely to support gay marriage. So there's a substantial divide there. There's also a major generational divide. The fraction of under 30 Michigan residents who are supporting of gay marriage, 67%. Really overwhelming support, whereas for the elderly, the 65 and over, it's only 47%. So even though the overall numbers have moved, that doesn't mean that all groups have changed in the same way or that all groups have the same views.
But this is it sounds like it's shaping up to be a bigger political dilemma for Republicans, because we know they're actively trying to court and attract younger voters, but at the same time, they have to keep that traditional old guard conservative side happy.
Well, I think it is it's a challenge. It's a challenge for any political party trying to hold together a coalition when you have different parts of the folks you'd like to appeal to who have different views about things. I think you're right that the majority view among the Republican Party is probably where the Michigan public as a whole was on gay marriage 10 years ago. But the Michigan public has moved fairly substantially.
MSU economics professor Charles Ballard directs the State of the State survey, which was completed February 10th and found that 54% of Michigan residents support gay marriage, 36% oppose it. Charlie, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Here's a question. What matters more to you, being able to drive faster or being able to walk or ride your bike without worrying about a speeding car? That's how the battle lines are forming over a package of bills soon to be introduced in the state legislature. They would allow the state to give drivers more leeway to put the proverbial pedal to the metal. Let's find out more now as we welcome Tim Fisher. He's with the Transportation for Michigan Coalition and the Michigan Environmental Council. Good to have you with us, Tim.
It's great to be here. Thanks a lot.
So these bills would let the state set speed limits using something that's called the 85th percentile model. Can you explain what that means?
Essentially, what the 85th percentile does is that the state police or the Department of Transportation will sit alongside of the roadway and do traffic counts of about 100 to 125 vehicles. They will measure the speed at which the vehicles are going. And what they're looking at is about the majority of motorists, and they're looking at their speed. So they'll discount the fastest 15%, and they'll discount the slowest 15%. And it's really the amount of drivers between the 60th and 85th percentile. It's that speed that they're focused in on.
So it's almost as if you're saying, what will the market bear on a good day of driving when there's no congestion, just left to its own devices? Here's what drivers are doing.
That's exactly right.
And I do see that school zones, city centers, and subdivisions are excluded from this.
That's correct.
Although school zones, really, it's a pretty limited area around a school, and you would certainly have a lot of children walking from outside the school zone to the school.
That's right. You know, yeah. It's ridiculous to think that the kids only live within a school zone. Most kids live outside of a school zone.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's an odd thing to try to legislate from Lansing. This should be left to the municipalities to really determine how fast people should be driving through the neighborhoods in particular. You know, when it's out in the open road, the highways and the bigger,
like the I-96s and the I-75s.
I-96, you know, that might be a different conversation. Mm-hmm. But right now, the Department of Transportation and the state police have the authority to adjust those speed limits already. So we're not quite sure what's going on here.
Okay.
What we've heard is that there are at least a couple of legislators who are concerned that this is a way for municipalities to raise revenue.
Speed traps. I know Senator Rick Jones is one of those who is behind this, who I've seen quotes of his saying that it's hard on the working poor. It's hard on drivers who are getting socked with speeding tickets and points. And so he thinks he's speaking up for them.
Right. It's highly suspicious. However, this revenue, you know, when you pay a ticket, it's $100 or $200 in that ticket. The money from that is really going mostly to the courts. If it's on a state road, it's going to fund libraries, schools. So it's not just going directly to city council. It is broken up by statute in a variety of different ways. So in order for this to be a significant revenue source, it would have to hand out a whole bunch of very high speeding tickets.
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with Tim Fisher. Tim's with the Transportation for Michigan Coalition, also the Michigan Environmental Council, as we look at kind of the battle lines forming over a package of five bills soon to be introduced in the legislature that would basically let the state give drivers more leeway to speed, because it would allow speed limits to go up based on what's called this 85th percentile model. And I get the sense that the backers feel this will make traffic flow more smoothly. People will be able to get where they want to go more quickly.
Yeah, and that's what some of the proponents have said, and I think to some degree they might have a point that if the speed limit is decreased from say 35 miles per hour to 25 miles per hour, and nothing else is done in that roadway,
right?
They say, and I think it's probably quite correct, that will have very little effect on the rate of speed of the traffic flow. And so what we really have to do is the most effective way to regulate speed is to really focus in on the roadway design. Mm. And that's where municipalities really need to step up the game and say that, you know, these roadways are in neighborhood zones. We don't want our cars traveling at high rates of speed. We need to do pedestrian islands. Sometimes we need to shrink the roadway, move the curbs in. Sometimes it can be done by just putting stripes on the road, designated bike lanes, parking. Arguably, better ways of regulating the speed.
Yeah, because it just strikes me that how would Lansing know as this bill would be passed and as it seems to be shaping up, how would they know what's happening in my neighborhood?
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Tim, if behind this idea of this 85th percentile model, let's talk about the freeways. Using this model, does it mean that we're all supposed to go that higher speed? The idea is you have less lane changing and stuff. Would there be a slower lane option for seniors or for young drivers who are just getting kind of their freeway skills, driving skills up and running?
Well, the minimum would bump up along with the maximum. And so there you really – because part of the argument in favor of increasing speeds at this 85th percentile is that you want most traffic flowing at about the same rate of speed. You don't want some folks going quite a bit slower while others are going quite a bit faster. So you want everyone kind of within a 5-mile-an-hour range.
It strikes me that kind of leaves especially older drivers who might be able to handle, because our minimum right now would be on our freeways. I know some of our freeways are 70. Is the minimum 55?
50. Yeah, it depends on the road. 60, 65.
Okay. Yeah, there probably are drivers and parents of young drivers who aren't really excited at the idea of their kids going 75 or 80 until they get better at driving, or seniors who don't feel comfortable either. It seems like the message is too bad.
That's part of our concern. And also with the state of our roads at this point, people are dodging around potholes.
Yeah.
And so really, you know, we would encourage the legislature to focus on the issues that matter and that are going to clobber us to death. And that's really transportation funding and funding a complete transportation system. We need to maintain the roads and bridges that we have. We also need to really ramp up the amount of money that we're spending on public transit and non-motorized and walk-in facilities. I took the bus down here from Lansing, the Michigan Flyer. It's a great service. I was able to work the hour and 10 minutes that it takes to come here. I didn't have to dodge potholes. The bus driver did that by himself. So really, these, you know, we need to expand those types of options across the state and not focus on these sideshow issues like speed traps.
Tim Fisher is with Transportation for Michigan Coalition, also the Michigan Environmental Council, as we kind of begin exploring what I'm sure is going to be a hot topic of conversation once these bills are introduced. Thanks so much for talking with us today, Tim.
Thanks a lot. Great to be here.
Let's move from traveling along the roads to traveling along a river. When I say that, you probably conjure up images of a beautiful warm day, a canoe or a kayak, maybe a packed picnic basket. But what about gliding along a Michigan river in the heart of winter? Scott Harper and his wife have been taking people on winter rafting trips down the Jordan River in northern Michigan for the past 15 years. They co-own Jordan Valley Outfitters in East Jordan. Hi, Scott.
Hello.
Take us through a typical outing.
Well, the trip is about an hour and a quarter to hour and a half long. We do stop partway down and have a hot drink and snack along the river's edge, hot cider, tea, or hot chocolate, and some cookies that my wife makes. And as you glide down the river, you will see all types of ice formations along the banks, Sometimes there's icicles that hang down with a large ball on the bottom. They look like a crystal clear upside down lollipop. There's a lot of animals, deer, ducks. We've seen wild turkey. Those are pretty common. And then other times we've seen mink, otter, beaver, things like that.
So things that we might not see if we were going down in the summer when things are so busy.
Well, absolutely. And the one thing that you will not have are deer flies or mosquitoes.
Over the 15 winters you've been doing this, Scott Harper, you must have been on the river in all kinds of conditions. What has this butte of a winter been like for you?
This one has been more of a challenge than the past years with the extreme cold temperatures. We do not run when it's single digits, just for the customer's comfort. And you tend to have much more ice on the river. And with single digits, it starts to freeze from the bottom up. And it just makes it, at times, almost impassable. And we've had to cancel a few weekends this year, which is very unusual.
Well, I can only imagine what it feels like to be, be with you rafting along the Jordan River with the snow falling. What's that like?
Honestly, the snowstorms or when it's snowing is my absolute favorite time to be out there. It's just like you're in a snow globe. I mean, it's just, it's quiet. You hear nothing but the rippling water. It's unlike any other winter experience that you would ever have.
Now, would I need to be an experienced rafter to take your trip, or can I be a newbie?
You can be a newbie. It is not necessary that you have experience. It's not even necessary that everybody paddles, because quite frankly, if we do too much paddling, the trip gets over too fast, and I certainly don't want that.
What do you think makes northern Michigan winters better than anywhere else?
Oh, boy. I guess that's it's just the serenity that you have, and I'm sure you have this other places as well, but to have this in your own backyard, and whether you live in northern Michigan or a few hours away, it literally is in your backyard, and there's just so much to do.
Scott Harper and his wife own Jordan Valley Outfitters in East Jordan, and they have been leading winter rafting trips along the East Jordan River for 15 years now. You can learn more about the river outings. Go to jvoutfitters.com. And I got to tell you, I'm in. It just sounds exquisite, and the photos on your website have me going, I'll bundle up. I'm up for this.
Well, thank you so much, and we hope to see you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattelsey, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and Jeff Horniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.